Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today we have an encore presentation of an interview I did with wildlife biologist Jim Bodkin about sea otters. This interview first aired in June 2016. But before we go to that, let's hear this week's mystery sound. And a little bit of a hint, to actually hear this sound in nature, you need to be up very early in the morning to hear the songs and the calls. So if you're out and about these days, and certainly everyone with a hummingbird feeder these past few weeks has been treated to entertaining explosions of hummingbirds, mainly the rufous hummingbirds. Sit outside some afternoon and you may see the action of the hummers as they dive from the sky only to pull up at the very last moment. It's a derring do to attract potential mates. Or watch as one boldly chases off potential competitors away from the feeders and away from their breeding territory. Well, we all know that hummingbirds exhibit wonderful displays of color. But in addition, unlike humans, who only have three different types of color receptors, they're called cones in the eyes, and in humans it's for red, green, and blue, hummingbirds have a fourth type of receptor that allows the hummingbirds to perceive ultraviolet colors that are entirely invisible to humans. Hummingbirds can perceive combinations like ultraviolet and green or ultraviolet and red, combinations that for humans, it's hard even to begin to conceive what that might look like. Just this past summer, research scientists have fascinated the biological world with extensive field experiments on hummingbird vision and behavior. The experiments definitively showed that the hummingbirds not only can see a large variety of colors beyond the spectrum that we humans can perceive, but they also use this information to choose food sources and probably to make other behavioral decisions. This opens inquiries that are so clearly outside customary human perceptions. The four color perception system is the norm for birds, for many fish and reptiles, and it almost certainly existed for the dinosaurs. In fact, this expanded color spectrum vision is widespread in the animal world. Consider for a minute, species such as the mantid shrimp have as many as 16 types of color perception receptors in their eyes. What can they see that we have absolutely no conceptual framework to understand using our own human-limited visual capabilities? Well, I'll leave you with that question for a minute to ponder, because I certainly don't have an answer, but it's just a really curious thing to think about. And let's go on to my conversation with Jim Bodkin. As I mentioned, in 2016, I interviewed Jim Bodkin about the biology of sea otters. Jim had recently retired to Port Townsend after a long and impressive career with the federal government as a research wildlife biologist in Alaska with the U.S. Geological Survey. Jim's focus was on population biology and ecology of marine mammals, especially sea otters, as well as coastal marine geology and marine conservation. A few weeks ago this summer, I encored part one of my interview with Jim about the biology of sea otters. And this week is part two of that interview.
Today, we're talking with Jim Bodkin again, and we're going to talk about the challenges faced by sea otters as a result of human interactions and the lessons that this interaction and these events provide about sea otter biology and their recovery and conservation. So, thinking historically for a moment, the fur trade comes to mind, but as sort of historical or maybe prehistorical context for that, did the indigenous native people hunt and use sea otters, and what did they use them for?
Yes, the answer is they certainly did use sea otters. We find evidence in archaeological middens throughout the North Pacific of the presence of sea otters, and oftentimes in quantities that suggest that they were actively pursued and collected. We also know that, at least in the northern part of the Pacific, in the Aleutians in particular, that the Aleut people developed a very sophisticated method to hunt sea otters, a communal method that required a fairly large number of individuals and individual kayaks. And in fact, that method was really the hunting technique that allowed for the fur harvest to begin.
So they were using the fur or food?
Yeah, they were probably using the fur. It's most likely that they were using the fur for warmth, and because of that, they were probably more used in the northern latitudes as opposed to in the southern latitudes.
Although I certainly would guess that any animal they hunted, they would use all of it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the furs were traded as well. We know that they were traded so that there's evidence of sea otters away from the coast, so that they were a commodity that was traded with other peoples.
So when we think about the historical fur trade, we think essentially about what the Russians, I guess, basically started. And they started in the Kurils or the Japanese islands, northern Japanese islands. And that would have been the early, mid-18th century, is that about right?
Right, about 1750 or so.
Okay, so the after Vitus Bering and all that stuff. I think most of us probably know that lasted through to the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, when, at which point, the sea otters were nearly extinct. So fill in the details. Tell us about the harvest. Why was it so lucrative? And when did the Americans kind of get into this game?
The furs were highly prized, again, because of the density and the luxuriousness of these furs. And most of the furs were going to Asia. There was a huge market, and they were extremely valuable. There were fortunes made early and throughout the period of harvest. In fact, these pelts were so valuable that towards the end of the fur trade, when otters were extremely rare, they actually would have vessels that would be out for months at a time and come back with just a few pelts.
That made enough money to support a month-at-a-time trip?
Right, right.
Wow.
Even though by the end of the fur trade, they became so rare that it became economically unfeasible to continue to pursue this commodity.
And you mentioned when we were chatting before we turned the recording on, that the early Russians actually enslaved some of the Aleuts?
Yeah, they did. Kind of a dark part of the story of the fur trade. But as the fur trade began, the Russian hunters basically enslaved the Aleuts, who had developed this ability to hunt sea otters essentially with spears, because this was before kind of modern firearms became available. So I doubt if we would have had this fur trade had it not been
for
the Aleuts, who had learned how to hunt sea otters.
And then the question about, okay, this is the Russians, they sort of enslaved the Aleuts, they've used their technique. When did this get to the North America, and when did the U.S. get involved in the fur trade?
It's kind of a complicated story, because the Russians were kind of a dominant and kind of managed the fur trade exclusively for about the first nearly 100 years.
Was Ivan Doig's Sea Runner story, was about a Russian camp. Was that a sea otter?
Right,
camp?
It included sea otters as part of that story, right?
So that was just sort of a brain flash.
The Russians were actually trying to regulate the harvest, because by the mid 19th century, they had seen the decline and the unsustainability of the harvest that was ongoing. And so They implemented some management that included harvesting only males to try to secure the long-term harvest here. But that was about the same time that it became an international harvest. And by this time, we were in North America, and we were working down the coast of North America. Once this international fleet came in, kind of all bets were off in terms of management, and it became more of a free-for-all, and rapidly led to kind of the near extinction and the removal of sea otters from, you know, over 99% of their habitat, and they're reduced.
And that's the entire rim of the North Pacific, essentially.
Right. And it reduced their numbers from probably close to 300 or 400,000 animals before the harvest, probably to a few hundred animals scattered through 13 different populations, mostly in the northern parts of their range, but with one population in California.
Thinking for a minute about the efforts for a sustainable harvest and that not working, and yet I understand that it didn't take, in terms of annually, a huge percentage of the population, but why wasn't it sustainable?
Well, it had to do with the way the harvest was allocated spatially. As we talked about previously, you know, these animals have a very small home range.
Mm-hmm. You said just a few kilometers.
A few square kilometers on an annual basis. And the harvest was concentrated. So even though only, you know, maybe 1 or 2% of the population was harvested every year, that harvest took place in a very small area. And then they would kind of move on to the next area and deplete that area. So if they had taken that 1% of the population annually, had it been distributed more broadly throughout the range, we probably never would have seen a decline in sea otters.
So I'm sort of envisioning this kind of progressive deplenishing of the sea otter population as they worked around.
Very much a kind of a serial depletion.
Serial depletion. That's a good way to think about it.
And that's where kind of the individual biology, the life history of the of the organism that you're harvesting comes into play. And you have to understand that in order to sustainably kind of harvest or manage a population.
Back to the home range issue. It's very small, relatively quite small.
Right.
Yeah. Most of us, I think, know that the sea otter population has rebounded in the 20th century. What happened?
A number of things happened. Probably first and foremost is during the course of the harvest, we took a lot of animals, but we didn't degrade their habitat. We didn't affect the habitat in the process. And so once we stopped harvesting them, there was good, suitable habitat. In fact, there was excellent habitat because in the absence of sea otters, their prey respond by increasing in size and abundance. And so after decades of absence of sea otters in the system, prey population is plentiful and it's abundant, and it facilitates rapid recovery of the sea otter population. So habitat was good. We stopped harvesting sea otters in 1911 under the protections of the International Fur Seal Treaty. And then later in the 20th century, we actually started conducting translocations or relocations of sea otters from Alaska, where there, some of their populations persisted, to places like British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon, and Southeast Alaska as well. And so today, somewhere about 20% of the sea otter's abundance, which is now at about 125,000, about 20,000 of those animals are the direct result of those translocations that took place in the beginning in the 1960s.
If I'm remembering the numbers correctly, it's the current population is not quite half of the sort of population at the beginning of the Russian fur trade, essentially.
Right.
And I know some of those translocations have been really successful and some have not. I know the effort off the coast of Oregon was not.
Right.
Any thoughts about why we have success somewhere and failure other places?
Well, the Oregon translocation was one of the earlier translocations, and we didn't know a great deal about husbandry and about the need for these animals to maintain the integrity of that fur. They're very susceptible to kind of contamination or degradation of the quality of their fur. So their fur basically has to be able to retain an air layer, because it's that air layer in the fur that actually provides
warm,
the insulation. Yeah. So that was one of the reasons for kind of some of the low success rates of the early translocations.
The initial,
Also, these animals have a strong affinity for their home range for where they live.
Of course, they live there a long time, and it's a small home range.
And they know
course,
it very well. Yeah. When we pick them up and we take them to a new habitat, even though the habitat to our eyes is excellent, has lots of food for them and no competition with other.
It's not home.
It's not home. And so we moved 142 animals out to San Nicolas Island in the 1980s, and within a year, 90% of those animals had gone.
Wow.
And we know that they swam back the 100 or more miles back to where we caught them, and they went back to their home range.
Yeah.
So that's another reason for the kind of the limited success of almost all the translocations. Mm-hmm. We see a large decline following the translocation, and then kind of a slow recovery until they actually start attaining this exponential growth rate that we've seen in
so
almost
where
all
takes,
of the successful.
It takes well.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. And then they can grow quite rapidly.
It was interesting to me when you were talking about the fur trade that there really was no impact on the habitat. The next thing I want to ask you about, which is the Exxon Valdez oil spill that many of us remember. It was spring of 1989.
Right.
Prince William Sound, when the Exxon Valdez oil tanker went aground, spilled massive amounts of crude oil. Many marine conservationists probably would consider it one of the greatest catastrophes. I remember the sea otter being almost the poster child of that oil spill, that catastrophe. And I know you were quite involved with the research following it. Tell us about the short-term impact of that spill on the sea otters.
Again, because of the reliance on the sea otter, on the integrity of its fur, and the effects that oil in particular has on matting that fur and basically
removing its insulation.
Right. We also saw a great deal of inhalation injury.
Oh, that huge nasal cavity, their fact, they're feeding and...
Right, and essentially they're breathing hydrocarbons. And so we saw pulmonary emphysema was a very common kind of symptom of animals that were dying or had died and others that had been brought into the rehabilitation facility. So because of that direct contamination of the fur and as well as inhalation of hydrocarbons, we don't know exactly how many animals died acutely, but it was probably at least 1,000 and potentially up to several thousand animals died from kind of acute effects of direct exposure to oil.
What were scientists assuming in those early years? Did they assume that the short-term impacts would pass and the sea otters and other critters would sort of come through it?
Begin the recovery process, right. It was assumed that acute effects would be the strongest effects and that those would diminish rapidly because the oil dissipates fairly quickly in the environment. But it turns out that wasn't necessarily the case for all species. It varied according to a species' individual biology. So in the case of sea otters, if we took out, let's say, 1,000 animals out of western Prince William Sound, which is probably close to what it was, the thinking was that, well, there was still lots of sea otters in Prince William Sound. They would simply move over to this now vacant habitat. Well, as we subsequently learned, these animals have a very small home range and a high fidelity to that home range, and they just didn't do that. The animals that survived in that area, they formed the nucleus, and they were the ones that would be responsible for the recovery. But what we also learned was that a fraction of this oil ended up being sequestered in intertidal shallow water sediments, the same kind of habitats that sea otters feed in. They're really great excavators. When they're digging for clams, they can spend a lot of time and they can remove a lot of sediments.
Yeah, and they can move rocks around and get under things.
And in the process, we found that they are becoming kind of continually exposed at a much lower level, of course, but that was, again, hampering recovery of sea otters. And so it was over 25 years before we actually saw kind of recovery to levels of sea otters in the most heavily oiled areas, at least, of western Prince William Sound. It took 25 years before the numbers approached what they were at the time of the spill. We probably were conservative, but we still know that there's still oil out there and that there's still animals that are likely becoming exposed to that oil. But the rate is diminishing over time, the volume of oil. in a large sense, sea otters were responsible for recovery of that habitat and that lingering oil that is in there through this process of excavating sediments, releasing that oil. But again, they paid the price in terms of kind of a prolonged recovery period, as did some other species.
Yeah. There's sort of some obvious takeaway messages from this, but what's your basic sort of biological or ecological takeaway message from the Exxon Valdez spill experience?
Well, first and foremost is that to understand the effects of our behavior, the human behavior on systems and species, we really have to have some information about what populations and communities, biological, ecological communities look like before the impacts that we impose have.
So unlike the fur trade, where it was mostly an individual biology, this is an ecology question.
Right. Well, in order to understand what the effects of these types of events are, and I don't want to limit it just to oil spills because there's lots of kind of catastrophes that'll happen. In order for us to understand what the effects are, we need to know what populations and what the ecosystems and the communities look like beforehand. And so that's an important lesson. And the other one was that we really didn't have the understanding of the natural history of the animal to fully understand what the long-term effects might be. And for some species, there's still not recovery. And we may not see recovery because of their individual kind of behaviors and life histories that just won't allow them necessarily to recover.
Jim, I want to thank you so much for sharing your expertise here on Nature Now. This has been fascinating.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, that was a really interesting discussion, and it makes me want to know more.
You know, listening to that interview about sea otters really makes me want to get out to the outer Washington coast and hopefully have a chance to see some of the sea otters that live out there. But unfortunately, I suspect, given this current world, it'll be a while before I get out there. So let's instead listen to that mystery sound. Well, that was the chipping and chatter of violet-green swallows, a beautiful swallow of the open woodlands. The violet-green swallow is found only in the American West. And lately around Port Townsend, we've been treated to the sights and sounds of these small birds as they swirp and swirl as small flocks in the skies overhead, catching insects. Watch carefully, and you can see the flash of their white bellies and the sneak peek of a small white flash near the tops of their tails. Well, there's an old wives' tale that says, when the swallows fly high, the weather will be dry. Or the other rhyming version of this is, swallows flying way up high mean there's no rain in the sky. So do you suppose that old wives' tale is true or false? Well, I think generally, high-flying swallows are probably more accurately a sign that the weather is already fine. It's a sign of current weather rather than a predictive forecast. However, there is some biological and meteorological background to the weather lore. Swallows are predators, and they do follow their prey, insects, particularly flies. And on warm summer days, thermal activity can carry bubbles of air many thousands of feet above the ground. This convection might be one of the main reasons for sweeping insects high into the sky on fine days, and the swallows, of course, fly progressively higher to feed on the insects. If bad weather arrives and the conditions turn cooler and windy, then the insects will rather seek the protection of trees and structures on the ground and are consequently flying lower. So eventually, the swallows follow their food, flying nearer to the ground as well. Well, one last note. You can, of course, still be getting out in nature during these coronavirus times. But if you're missing the more organized events such as nature walks, work parties, talks, check out the virtual events and the nature walks for groups less than five people that are offered through the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, Jefferson Land Trust, Admiralty Audubon, Olympic Peninsula Audubon, and the Native Plant Society. Check their websites and other social media sites for more information.